Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Ravish Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Bhavina Rodriguez, who is adjunct faculty at the Starr King School for the Ministry at the Graduate Theological Union. We'll be speaking about a really fascinating new publication called A Shakta Method for Comparative Theology, Upside Down, Inside Out. Ravina, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj. Super excited to be here.
So tell us a Shakta method. Maybe say a little word about what Shakta means for some of the more generalist audience, and then maybe tell us a little bit about how you got interested in this project.
So Shakta comes from, you know, Shaktas are basically those who worship Shakti. And Shakti is divine energy, it's power, it's feminine energy in the Hindu tradition. So Shaktas are those who worship the goddess in the Hindu tradition, just as, those who worship Christ are called Christians. So those who worship Shakti are called Shaktans. And how I got interested, how I basically started work on this project. So I've been thinking about some of these themes as a doctoral student and what a Shakta method for comparative theology would look like, or even what a Shakta theology of religions would look like. And then I decided to sort of engage these themes in my dissertation. So when I wrote the initial draft, we were in a pandemic and there was a lot that was going on at that time. I had to move apartments. I was actually living in an armed housemate situation, which got life-threatening. So the first draft that I wrote was not a clear reflection of my writing skills. So several years later, I picked up the project and revised it and in a much more peaceful environment. I mean, I still wish that I had like a quiet beach house, but you know, I had to work.
Don't we all?
It really helps the writing project, but that's how a lot of these themes, basically, I started to think about a lot of these themes as a doctoral student, and also as someone who has been raised Catholic and then got initiated into the Shakta tradition. So how would Shaktas think about other religions, and what would that framework look like if it had to come from the Devi Mahatmyam?
Well, the Devi Mahatmyam is a text that I have a little bit of familiarity with.
Yeah, a little bit.
Really, I sort of switch into a podcast host more rather than specialist or scholar mode for the podcast. But I'd be fascinated to know, what is it that struck you about that text? Like, what was your experience in looking through the Devi Mahatmyam? Maybe you could say a quick word about what that text is. And why did you think it would make for interesting fodder for comparative theology, comparative religions?
So, you know, when I think of the Devi Mahatmyam, and what you probably know, and it is that it is a central text for all those who worship the goddess in the Hindu tradition. And whether you go to North India, to South India, to, you know, East India, wherever you go, you may have different translations, or you may have different versions, that in the sense that the way it's chanted is different, but it is still a central text. And the reason why I was totally drawn to it was because it's just so fascinating. And I thought that it would be really great if I could bring that central text into a conversation, you know, with comparative theologians. So that's the reason why I sort of thought of, bringing the Devi Mahatmyam and looking at it philosophically, and also basically engaging a part of the Devi Mahatmyam which is generally not engaged, you know, the rahasyams. So when you look at academic texts and everything that is written, scholars don't really talk about the rahasyams, or they don't talk about the Devi Atharvashesha, which is a chant, and which basically has the essence of the entire Devi Mahatmyam. And it's beautiful when it is chanted and when it's in Sanskrit. So I thought of engaging all of that, because the mysteries are sort of unveiled and they are unfolded in the rahasyams. So I thought it would be great if I could bring that into conversation and thinking about other religions.
Yeah, fascinating. So for those listening, many of you have probably heard us talk about this text in passing, but the Devi Mahatmyam is a really fascinating work in that it is the oldest Indic Sanskritic articulation of a great goddess, you know, the supreme being feminine. And really, to my knowledge, this is really the only surviving great goddess cult tradition from antiquity. So it really is a fascinating, pivotal work. Surprisingly, there's so few of us who are really looking at this work, and yet it's really the only source text we have for traditions which say that the divine is a she, one of the first ones. It's chanted, just one more quick gloss for those listening. So in addition to being a mythological text, it has a rich liturgical ritual life, and it's chanted, the 13 chapters are chanted alongside what Bravina was talking about, the rahasyams, the secrets or the mysteries, and other glorious hymns, the Argala, the Kilaka, and this Atharvashirsha. So part of what's innovative is that you're actually doing analysis on the Chandipat, the ritual appendages of the Devi Mahatmya, for content. And so what is it that you find? What is it that you find in the rahasyas, et cetera, that so interests you for this comparative theology?
So what I find interesting in the rahasyams, in these mysteries, that is what rahasyams mean, is that it articulates how the world has come into existence. So there's this concept of, you know, the one, and then that's but the source matter of the one, and these are, you know, I don't want to get too much into Sanskrit, but the term that is used is Pradhanikam Rahasya, which means that the source matter for the universe is actually the goddess herself. And then in the Vaikritikam Rahasyam is how this original primordial matter basically mutates, and that's the meaning of the term Vaikriti, and you know how from this original source matter all form comes into existence. And then we have the Murti Rahasyam, which basically means the form, and of course ritually it sort of delineates who are the various gods and goddesses that have to be worshipped. But what is interesting, and this is a mystery, is that everything that we're looking at, sentient, insentient, everything that we touch, we feel, that we see, is actually a form of the goddess. You know, we tend to think that this is inanimate, this is insentient, this doesn't really have life. But actually, everything that we're looking at, that we stand on, that we walk, that we breathe, is all a form of the swarupa, the true nature of the goddess.
And say a bit more about this method that you propose, this Shakta method for comparative theology.
Yeah, so what I do is I propose a method, I propose anti-method, and I also propose a method. So first is basically anti-method. And what I argue is that among comparative theologians, and the way basically theology is being studied right now is that it's hypertextual, and there is a privileging of the mind. And the entire human body is an instrument, a yantra, in order to understand ultimate reality. You basically have to look at the body, mind, and the sense complex non-hierarchically. And when you look at it non-hierarchically, what happens is that you are not just privileging one aspect or just the intellect, and you're not just trying to read something in order to understand it through reason, but you're engaging other parts of your senses, other parts of your body. And that's how you can sort of understand ultimate reality. So that's anti-method. And then there is a-method. And a-method basically comes from, that's the subtitle of the book, Upside Down. So it's upside, it comes from the Ashwatha tree, which is the Bhagavad Gita. Now, this upside down tree, which has its roots in heaven and its branches towards the earth. So you're looking at reality in an upside down way, and it's basically mystical reality where you have sort of surrendered your entire being, your senses to the divine, and then you just go with the flow of the universe. This doesn't mean that you don't make decisions. You make decisions, and if you want to understand something, you still understand. You place that intention before the universe. But that way of being is quite different from it's a passive way of being, where you are just taken with the flow of the universe, and then you understand reality, and reality will just start presenting itself to you. So that's the A method. And for method, what I propose is, a gestural method, an auditory method, and a haptics, a method that uses touch, nyasa, which all comes from the puja ritual. So the auditory method is basically method that has to do with mantra, when you're listening to things. And not just recitation, it can be poetry, so not just prose, it's song. So that all comes under the auditory method. And then the gestural method has to do with mudras, of the way you want to connect your body to ultimate reality, or the way you're connecting your senses to ultimate reality. And then there's haptics, touch. And when I talk about touch, I'm not specifically talking about touch in terms of communicating with human beings, but keeping one's senses, one's body open to being touched by other realities. So that's basically the method, anti-method, and a-method that I propose for comparative theology.
Say a bit more about the intervention that you're hoping so accomplished with the book. What is the state of the field at present, and what's different about what this book is doing?
So I think that what's happening is, as I mentioned in chapter one of the book, is that there is a lacuna in the sense that Hindu theologians are missing, right, in comparative theology. And what's happening is that, so there's like this imbalance where you have people from other traditions doing their best to describe, to articulate a theology of religions, to talk about other religions, and to sort of present what it would be like. But we have very few scholars and who are trained comparative theologians who are sometimes not even interested in doing comparative theology. So it's important, I think, because first is it presents a Hindu perspective and a Hindu Shakta perspective on what a theology of religions would look like if it had to be based on a specific text in the Hindu world. And then it also proposes, certain ways of basically engaging in inter-religious dialogue. So it would not just be an intellectual engagement because everything in the Hindu world is so evocative. It's so bright and beautiful. There's an engagement of the senses. You would light a flame, you would light a candle, there would be incense, there would be flowers. So there's a way of sort of immersing yourself in a specific a context and then understanding the other. So I think that it's really important because it sort of takes the focus off the way theology is being done, which is a very dry method, just reading text. And it encourages people to basically situate themselves, and especially those who are interested in interreligious dialogue and comparative theology. It encourages them to basically move into these communities and to sit and to learn and to engage people in real time. So that's basically what it does.
So an emphasis on embodiment, perhaps.
Yes, totally. Somatic experiences, and I use that term quite a bit, somatic experiences, an experience of the senses, of the visual realities, and sitting in a temple, listening to chants, and then see what comes up for you, and then engaging that question, as you participate in your ritual or more with a community, with people, so on and so forth. Yeah.
Is this work that you are continuing somehow?
What do you mean? As in,
in terms of further research, I mean, is this something where you feel, okay, well, this method has been hashed out, it's all good and well for now, or is it something you hope to develop or continue working on?
I'm waiting to see some book reviews and what people think about it. And if I feel like it, I need to elaborate certain sections or certain parts of what has been said, then I will definitely continue. But I get bored very easily, so I'm also trying to look for other things and other projects and working on other things right now.
Are they Shakta projects?
Yeah, they are. There's one that I'm working on right now, which is basically, it's an edited volume, and it'll have contemporary essays on the Daily Mahatmyam. So it could be like a literary lens, or a social lens, or a spiritual lens, a womanist or a feminist lens, all the Daily Mahatmyam. So it has like a bunch of contemporary essays.
Fascinating. Tell me a bit more about what is it about the Daily Mahatmyam that so fascinates you? What does it tell? Share a bit about the draw. What was the draw? What was the, perhaps how you got introduced to the text, and why is it that it so captivated you?
So I think it has to do with my personal experience. That's as soon as I got initiated, that's the first text that came to mind. And actually, I started to listen to it. I started to read about it. And I started to chant it. And I realized that as I was chanting, there were a lot of things that that I was learning, and I found it incredibly fascinating, because there's also this energy in the text, within the mantras, and just chanting of the text really it is really beautiful. So that as a mode in order to basically understand ultimate reality or one's purpose in life or whatever intention that one might have. So that is something that basically fascinated me. And then as I read, I was like, oh, it would be great to sort of unpack this even, philosophically, theologically. So that's basically what I started to do. And I totally enjoy the experience. Yeah,
I can relate. It really is a captivating text. It's so unique in presenting the feminine as supreme, and it's so masterful at weaving together strands of previous ideas and motifs, mythic motifs and philosophical concepts into this vision. It's presenting something new within the Indic world, and also saying, no, she's already been here. We've been talking about her as property, as Maya, and it's an utterly fascinating text. Actually, my dissertation, which was my first book, was the first narrative analysis of the Devi Mahatmya, looking at it as a narrative and making sense of its structure as a ring composition, for example. It really is a captivating text.
Oh yeah, totally. And I think what's great about it is that it's sort of, it's great because it asserts the the not just the transcendent aspect, because there are a lot of religious traditions that talk about the transcendent aspect, but it talks about prakriti, about, you know, materiality as being divine, and not just divine, but as being the goddess herself, you know, her form. And I don't know. And when I think about, you know, just what other text has done that, I can't, nothing comes to mind. I'm sure there are some texts out there in the world, but at least I'm not aware of them. But yeah.
So. Well, it seems to me an important corrective in the pendulum swinging back towards center from sort of this Upanishadic idea, this ascetic idea that the divine is wholly beyond and transcendent. And I think part of what's captivating, at least teaching on the Devi Mahatmya in sort of Western continuing studies contexts, part of what's captivating is divine immanence. That really, you know, what better text do we have within the Indic world that can serve as a platform for ecological activism, for example? Or the valuing of the embodied state in all bodies, you know, she who resides in all bodies, all beings, men, women, children, et cetera, et cetera. And so, to my mind, it's surprising that this text would have been preserved, or even sort of would have been crafted within a Brahmanic, obviously patriarchal world, but clearly her worship was so trenchant. I mean, clearly, presumably, there were so many individuals worshiping her on the folk level that they had to give her a Sanskrit text. But they did a masterful job of not just creating a deity with a feminine face, but really theologizing and mythologizing the feminine mode, the feminine principle. Right. And I think divine immanence is a crucial part of that.
Yeah. And I think that the theology is so deep. It has like multiple levels. You have to sort of unpack it. And even though you may read it, you have to sort of develop like an experiential understanding of what it is. And it's really wonderful that it's still being recited in temples, you know, and during the Navratri, which is the 9-day festival dedicated to the Great Mother Goddess, you know, you have the Devi Mahatmya that is chanted. So it's really beautiful that it is still being valued, and it should be. About the philosophy, theological or the theological aspects also sort of have to be recognized, which I think is sometimes not understood by a lot of people, but I think that part, once I think people start recognizing that part, I think it'll be great and be much more wonderful than what it already is.
Well, narrative, mythological narratives do the heavy lifting of theology, but they do so in a sort of covert, entertaining, charming, sometimes naive, you know, the manner. They're unassuming in the truths that they encode. So the narrative is utterly rich. But if you tease out the philosophical view, the vision of the Devi Mahatmya, it's profound. And it's unlike anything we see in the Indic world. And to my knowledge, it's unlike anything we see in any religion, actually.
Yeah. You know, Raj, I'm writing another paper, and it's really interesting. So in that paper, it's a short paper, I argue that in the Devi Mahatmya, there is a hidden form of Shakta Yoga. And we can sort of understand what the Shakta Yoga is if we understand Sanskrit terms. So for example, you know, the name of the king is Surata. So that means noble chariot. And chariot is another metaphor for yoga. And then we have Samadhi, who comes and who's a merchant. And, you know, they both meet and, you know, the story. So the merchant, whose name is Samadhi, and we know Samadhi means altered states of consciousness. So within the Devi Mahatmya, there's literally so much, just like all these hidden golden nuggets. So I argue that within the Devi Mahatmya, there is also a form of Shakta Yoga, which depends on the justice and, you know, the power of the goddess. And it is the goddess whose grace basically enables the practitioner to reach altered states of consciousness and also to understand ultimate reality. So it's a much more faster way of understanding ultimate reality.
Fascinating. We'll have to continue a conversation about this. Is there anything else about this book that you wanted to touch on before we close?
No, I think I really enjoyed writing the book, and I hope that whoever reads it will also sort of benefit from, you know, from everything that is sort of delineated in the book. Yeah.
Great. Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you very much.
For those listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Pravina Rodriguez on a Shakti method for comparative theology, upside down, inside out. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, and keep contemplating the power of the feminine. Take care.